Lecture number 2, Dinosaurs and the Book of Genesis. Many people are saying that it is naive to look for any record of dinosaurs in the Old Testament. But if these gigantic creatures were prominent features of the early earth, would God have left us in total ignorance of them? The entire question of dinosaurs creates tension and serious doubt in the minds of thousands of people that the Bible presents a true picture of Earth history. It's very important, I believe, therefore, to recognize what the Scriptures do say on this fascinating subject. Turn now, please, to Genesis chapter 1, verse 24, as we search the Scriptures on the subject of dinosaurs, beginning with the opening chapter of the Bible. As the scene opens in verse 24, we have arrived at the last of the 6 days of creation. God is now about to create the great creatures of the earth's surface, climaxing in man himself. Listen carefully to what God created on that sixth day. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kinds, cattle and creeping things, and beasts of the earth after their kind." And it was so. The expression "creeping things," a broad term including lizards, reptiles, snakes, and such like that move across the surface of the earth and are very familiar to men. In more detail, verse 25 goes on to say that God made the beasts of the earth after their kind and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the ground after its kind. And God saw that it was good. And now, verse 26, as man, the ruler, the king of the earth, is created. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." Notice the constant repetition of the all-inclusiveness of man's dominion over every kind of animal, including every creeping thing that this world has ever known. Now, of course, many students of the Bible have been accustomed to dismissing such statements as referring to dinosaurs because it has been thought for many generations that back in Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, there was a vast period of time that intervened between the original creation of the world in its perfect form, Genesis 1:1, and the supposedly chaotic scene of Genesis 1:2. This is popularly known as the gap theory. And we have been told that in that little hiatus within the account of creation, that the vast geologic ages took place, during which time dinosaurs existed and then became extinct forever, long before man appeared on the earth in the recreation in 6 literal days described in the rest of Genesis chapter 1. But on closer inspection, the idea that dinosaurs had died out vast ages before Adam was created is seriously contradicted by other very important statements of the Bible. For example, I would like to read the last verse, the summary verse of Genesis chapter 1, in verse 31. I'm going to read this erroneously to make an emphatic point here as to what the verse really does not say, in fact cannot say, and then I will read it correctly. "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, much of it had long since become fossilized." The actual reading is as follows: "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good." Now, everything that God made includes everything: angels, Satan, the animal kingdom, the earth itself. And at this stage in God's creative work, no catastrophe had yet been introduced, no sin, no violence, no death, no fossilization, whatever. And therefore it is impossible to imagine Adam as being the superintendent of a vast graveyard in which the fossils of long extinct animals could be seen. He was the master, the king of a living world, in which every kind of creature, including creeping things, were still alive and well, submissive to him, in cooperation with him as the unfallen king of the earth. The Bible makes it very clear that Adam had a total dominion. He was not in competition with a previously fallen king, namely Satan. Some might ask, well, when did Satan fall then? And what was the effect of his fall? The Bible doesn't clearly state this, but it is obvious that if Satan was still an unfallen being at the end of creation week, at the time of Adam's creation, and he is a fallen being in chapter 3 of Genesis, his fall must have occurred sometime between the creation of Adam and the temptation event of Genesis 3. It did not take him millions of years to fall. The Lord Jesus Christ said, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. The moment a sinful heart was detected in that creature by God, he was flung out of God's presence and came to planet Earth seeking his victim in man. The effect of Satan's fall, then, was not a supposed catastrophe, a global deluge, a fossilization event in Genesis 1-2. But it was the Edenic curse described in Genesis 3 and referred to many times in the later portions of the Bible. It is really quite incredible, therefore, that death had occurred long before Adam, the king of the earth, was put to the test and chose to disobey God. Romans chapter 5, verse 12, for example, says that it was by one man that sin entered the world, not one angel, not Satan. But by one man, sin entered the world, and death by sin. And so death passed upon all men, for all sinned. Now, some have said that perhaps that refers only to human death, and that animals had been dying for millions of years. But the book of Romans, the great doctrinal treatise of the New Testament, does not permit that. The fate of the animal kingdom is vitally involved with man's relationship to God, all through the Bible. But especially we see this in Romans chapter 8, verse 20. The whole creation, not just man, the whole creation was made subject to vanity. Not by reason of itself, some supposed inherited defect in the animal kingdom that caused carnivorous characteristics and death and violence and fossilization of their remains. No, it was by reason of him, God, who subjected the same in the hope that the creation itself might someday be delivered from its bondage of corruption to the glorious liberty of the sons of God. In other words, someday when God's kingdom is established on earth. According to Isaiah 11 and other passages, the animal kingdom will be released from its bondage of corruption and share with man a new relationship to God in peace and mutual harmony. That is a goal, a promise toward which the entire Bible moves with great anticipation. Paul said, we know that the whole creation groans and travails in pain together until now. And even we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit, born again Christians, groan within themselves waiting for the adoption, that is the redemption of our body, namely the day of resurrection, which will accompany the second coming of Christ, which is the time when the great kingdom will be established and the effects of the Edenic curse will be drastically modified in this world. Therefore, as you look back on Genesis 1, you see the original condition which God someday, by his grace, will restore to man and the animal kingdom. It was not an end product of millions or billions of years of groaning and travail, but a fresh, new, perfect, harmonious, beautiful world that God created. If that weren't enough, we have in Exodus 20, verse 11, God's statement to the effect that really there was no time for a gap of years or millenniums or millions and billions of years, surely, between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. God spoke to Israel and said, 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, and rest the seventh, for in 6 days the Lord thy God created heaven, earth, sea, and all that in them is. In other words, even the events of Genesis 1:1, the creation of the heaven and the earth, with its shoreless ocean, created by God, was within the six-day period. No gap is allowed in Exodus 20:11 in our interpretation of Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. Furthermore, if the great catastrophe that buried the dinosaurs and billions of other creatures occurred back in Genesis 1:2, you must minimize drastically the universality, the effects geologically of the Genesis flood of Noah's day, which receives the supreme emphasis in the book of Genesis, and which, by the way, Christ and the Apostle Peter referred to more than once as the flood, the great aqueous catastrophe, the great hydrodynamic mechanism for fossilization, if you will, of the billions of creatures that were alive at that time in Earth history. It was the Genesis flood of Genesis chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9 that brought about fossilization and sedimentation and volcanism and upheaval and transformation of the Earth's crust and the geologic column of superimposed layers. There was no flood in Genesis 1:2. It is simply a description of the world as God created it. Some would say, well, how could the world have been covered with water and shrouded in total darkness if God had created it? Is he not the God of light? Yes, he is the God of spiritual light, but the Bible makes clear that God also created darkness. In fact, in Genesis 1, he named the darkness night, just as he named the light day. And the whole chapter of creation and provision and naming ends up in the last verse. God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Darkness was not a mark of evil or satanic dominion. In fact, Psalm 104 said that God made the darkness for the beasts to crawl out and to seek their food. And so God balanced light and darkness day and night in a beautiful harmony, appropriate for man in his beautiful created home. Now, it's true that in Genesis 1:2, the condition of the earth was such that it wasn't appropriate for man. It was not inhabitable. And yet that does not mean it was wrecked, ruined, judged, chaotic, and satanic. We can say that the world as God created it was absolutely perfect. The rocks were perfect. The shape of the earth was perfect. The water was perfect. The atmosphere was perfect in its proportion of gases and so on, but it was incomplete as far as man was concerned as a home to live in. Man is not of such a nature physically that he could live on a shoreless ocean in total darkness. But step by step throughout the creation week, God provided a fully furnished, formed, filled world. And finally, when it was furnished and filled and shaped according to God's original plan, then he put man into that home. In other words, the earth, when God first created it, was like Adam's body when he was first created. God looked at Adam and said, "Not good," Genesis chapter 2. But that does not mean that he was a wrecked and ruined, diseased, wounded person. No, it simply meant that he was incomplete. He was physically perfect, but he was incomplete at that stage of creation events. And therefore, God completed the perfect Adam by providing for him a perfect woman. And thus God could look back on the entire event of creation week and say, "Very good." There are many other arguments against the gap theory which could be mentioned, and I would refer to you a book that I have written entitled The Early Earth, And the final chapter of this book analyzes other arguments that have been frequently used, such as the idea that in Genesis 1:28, God told Adam to replenish the earth, but literally that simply means to fill. The Hebrew word maleh does not imply a refilling from a previous emptying or destruction. Jeremiah chapter 4 and Isaiah 34 do not teach that the term tohu vabohu, or without form and void, always has to mean judgment and chaos. In those contexts it does, but in other places those words tohu, empty, have a different connotation. We have to understand the terms in the light of the context in which they're used, a basic principle of interpreting the Bible. And furthermore, in Isaiah 45:18, God says he did not create the earth to be empty, that is, to remain empty, but to be inhabited. And that means that Genesis chapter 1 must be seen as a whole, as a complete unit, that God created the world, finally, to be an inhabitable world, a world for men to live in, with the animals and the birds and fishes, creatures that God put there under his dominion. Therefore, even though the gap theory has been prominent among Christian people for over 100 years, widely popularized, instead of being a help to explain the dinosaur problem, it has been a hindrance. It has permitted, in fact, forced Christians to dismiss dinosaurs as creatures that have nothing to do with our modern world. That the creatures that God created, in other words, like dinosaurs, have no genetic connection whatsoever with the kinds of creatures we have today. But we shall see that all the kinds that God created reproduce after their kind, and many of the creatures that are buried with dinosaurs still do have their modern living counterparts, their perpetuated kinds in our modern world. Therefore, it is impossible, in my opinion, to deny that dinosaurs were under Adam's original dominion. Now, this brings us to the question, what happened to these creatures at the time of the curse and at the time of the great flood? The Genesis curse, described in chapter 3, involved, I believe, a drastic transformation of many kinds of previously harmless, beautiful, useful plants into noxious, poisonous, and harmful plants, thorns, weeds, and thistles, by a transformation of the genetic code, the DNA code, in many of these kinds of plants. The same thing, I believe, happened in the animal kingdom, that the genetic systems of many creatures that had previously been harmless and helpful to man were transformed miraculously by God, so that in the next generation, out of the eggs, in the offspring that came forth in the following generation after the curse, many of these creatures were carnivorous, flesh-eating, poisonous, deadly to men. And we know that the creatures still maintain their outward identity, because in Isaiah 11 it tells us that when the coming kingdom age appears, lions will revert to their original created condition and will start eating straw again like oxen do, and bears and leopards likewise will be herbivores, plant eaters, as they were during creation week. You see in Genesis chapter 1 verse 30, all animals, including the most deadly types in the modern reptile and mammalian world, were all plant eaters, and therefore harmless and submissive to man in that beautiful world that God created. But now it is a totally different scene for many creatures. And I believe personally that in the initial intensity of the Edenic curse, that many of these creatures became horrible enemies, threats to the well-being of man. We know, for example, that there was a creature before the flood called Tyrannosaurus Rex. We have found a number of skeletons of this great dinosaur that was 50 feet long, stood at least 14 feet high, and weighed at least 12,000 pounds. He was equipped with a huge 4-foot-long jaw with many teeth, 6 inches long, double-edged, razor-sharp, with which he could destroy anything that crossed his path. He was truly the king, Rex, of terrifying Tyrannosaurus lizards. And I'm sure that man was threatened by this monster as he would bring home his miserable portion from his jungle garden according to the intensity of the curse God pronounced upon Adam and his descendants in Genesis 3. And as he would move home along the jungle pathway, suddenly looming up before him would be the specter of the monstrous Tyrannosaurus that would threaten his very life. Fascinating indeed is the concept in Genesis 6 that the whole earth was filled with violence through creatures like this that destroyed not only each other but deliberately attacked man, because Genesis 9:2 says that not till after the flood did God modify the fierceness of creatures and their determination to destroy man as king of the earth. Therefore, our concept of the effect of the curse has been confirmed by the kinds of creatures we have discovered in the world today and in their fossil formations. 1,656 years after the creation of the world and the Edenic curse, God brought upon this world a universal mountain-covering year-long deluge. God provided for man and air-breathing creatures a gigantic barge called Noah's Ark to preserve through that flood the seed of all air-breathing creatures. Some would say it is impossible to imagine dinosaurs, however, as having a part in that preservation process. Notice carefully the statement in Genesis chapter 7, verse 7, as to what actually did go into Noah's Ark. And Noah went in, and his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him into the ark. That's 8 human beings. Verse 8. Of clean beasts, that means animals that were acceptable by God on an altar of sacrifice. A vast minority, by the way, of the living kinds of the world. And of beasts that are not clean, and of birds, and of everything that creepeth upon the ground. These creatures, called creeping things, are obviously the same description given in Genesis chapter 1 that had to include the dinosaur. In other words, by the time of the flood, apparently, in the ideal, warm, humid environment of that pre-flood world, no creatures had yet become extinct. And the dinosaur was still alive and well, even though deadly in some cases, in reference to man. But during the time of the gathering of animals to the ark, God supernaturally controlled the vicious, carnivorous characteristics of these particular creatures, lions, bears, leopards, and the flesh-eating dinosaur types, and brought them supernaturally to the ark, controlling, subduing their nature, in fact, during the year of the flood, with a supernaturally imposed hibernation experience. God reduced their body functions to a minimum, so that it was not Noah's responsibility either to gather or to control and care for these creatures. God is the one who initiated this, and God is the one who carried it through by supernatural intervention in this unique phase of Earth history during the catastrophism of the global deluge. Now, some would object that dinosaurs were too large to go into Noah's Ark. But that is a double fallacy that needs to be honestly faced. First of all, we have underestimated the size of that ark. And secondly, we have overestimated the size of the particular creatures, including dinosaurs, that went into the ark. First of all, then, how large was Noah's ark? Well, we need not speculate on the matter because Genesis chapter 6, verse 15 tells us that it was 300 cubits long. Now, a cubit was the distance between the elbow and the tip of the middle finger of an adult man, approximately a foot and a half, 18 inches. Therefore, Noah's ark was about 450 feet long. It was 75 feet wide. It was 45 feet high, three stories, thus with a deck area of 100,000 square feet. It had a cubic capacity of 1,400,000 cubic feet, the equivalent of 520 modern railroad boxcars. Now, it has been estimated by taxonomists and zoologists that all the kinds of air-breathing creatures in our world today, from elephants to mice and everything in between, could be comfortably transported in not more than 150 railroad boxcars. But that would only be one of the three decks of Noah's Ark, and therefore the additional two decks would be available for two each of every kind of air breather that ever lived, including the dinosaurs, plus room for food for storage in that ark, and room for Noah's family as well. In other words, the ark was adequate in size for its God-intended purpose of preserving through the flood two each of the basic air-breathing kinds that could not otherwise survive in the water outside the ark through the many months of the flood. But we need, secondly, to consider the fact that the particular dinosaurs that God brought to the ark need not have been the most gigantic individuals in the world. Now, it's true that we have found in fossil formations gigantic dinosaurs, but those obviously were not in the ark. They were destroyed, buried, fossilized by the flood waters. But there is a very fascinating discovery that has been made about these kinds of creatures. Not a very recent discovery. In fact, for those who are knowledgeable of reptiles and lizards, it is a very fascinating thing to notice that even after they attain maturity to lay eggs and reproduce after their kind, these creatures keep on getting bigger and bigger and longer and heavier. So that in order to preserve that kind of creature, for example, the Tyrannosaurus Rex, through the flood in the ark, God did not have to find the two oldest, largest, heaviest specimens to bring into the ark, but would bring younger and therefore much, much smaller representatives of that kind. Human beings and mammals do not have this capacity for continual growth beyond the age of maturity in terms of reproduction. By the time human beings are old enough to be parents, they're also as tall as they will ever be. But that is not true of these kinds of creatures. Some of the truly enormous dinosaurs, which were vegetarian herbivores, like Supersaurus, Brontosaurus, and Brachiosaurus, became so colossal in their size that they, in some cases, could hardly walk anymore, and sat in swamps and rivers, and it is unthinkable that God would have dragged to the ark such creatures that were so ponderous, when much, much smaller representatives would have been perfectly appropriate for surviving the flood in the ark and laying their eggs in the post-flood world to reproduce after their kind. Therefore, this is largely a problem of imagination, which under closer inspection, like all Bible science problems, tends to evaporate. Now, as you consider the event that happened upon the termination of the flood year, the drastic transformation that took place on planet Earth in terms of not only topography and geography, but also of climate, it must be recognized that this was a fatal blow to the survival of the truly great dinosaurs that God created. We believe that the flood was caused by two basic sources of water. Genesis 7:11 and 12 tells us, first of all, that the fountains of the great deep broke up. But also, secondly, the windows of heaven were opened, a figure of speech that God uses to describe the collapse of the great vapor canopy that he had created on the second day of creation week, that preserved the earth's heat, even in polar regions, with what we may call a greenhouse effect. This tremendous vapor canopy trapped the earth's heat and evenly distributed it, and thus provided the possibility for millions of animals to graze peacefully even in what are today uninhabitable regions of the northern Siberian Alaska. And when that great vapor canopy collapsed, the heat permanently escaped in the higher latitudes, replaced by stupendous masses of supercool air, which in some cases instantly froze solid mammoths that were grazing peacefully, living off of vegetation that today can't even grow in those regions. In fact, the remains of over 5 million mammoths have been found in northern Siberia, the greatest source of ivory for 1,000 years in the ivory trade. Now, in order for a mammoth with a skin 4 inches thick at his stomach, covered with hair, could not possibly be frozen solid with the vegetation perfectly preserved in his mouth and stomach unless a mass of air at least 180 below zero had struck him. Not all the mammoths were frozen solid, but enough of them to show us the stupendous, rapid transformation of a tropical global climate into the varied climates that we see in our world today. Now, at the time then of the flood, in the higher latitudes, up toward the Arctic zones, a permanent deep freeze began, and all the rain that fell, fell in the form of snow that never melted and heaped up to enormous masses of ice that under tremendous pressure moved down into what is today the Great Lakes region of the United States and into Northern Europe and gouged out huge areas that then subsequently, through melted ice, became glacial lakes, freshwater lakes, and left the typical glacial moraines and eskers and characteristics of glacial action. All of this must have been caused by the great flood and the collapse of that vapor canopy. The actual mechanism of that deluge and the effect that the vapor canopy had in bringing the flood and the change of climate has been very carefully worked out mathematically by Mr. Dillow, whose book on the waters above, published by Moody Press of Chicago, a 500-page analysis of how that vapor canopy functioned in the pre-flood world, what happened when it collapsed. A very fascinating, controversial issue, the mechanism by which a tropical world is transformed into the kind of world and distribution of temperature that we know today. Now, when the inhabitants of Noah's Ark emerged at the end of the flood year, they were therefore confronted immediately with a drastic change of climate. You see, Noah's Ark did not land in the tropics in an equatorial region. It landed in a temperate zone of what is today eastern Turkey and southern Russia, the mountains of Ararat, between the Black Sea and the Caspian. And in that area, it becomes very cold at night and in the winter. And therefore, the giant reptilian forms, like Tyrannosaurus rex and Brontosaurus and so forth, had two options in terms of survival. They could either burrow into the mud, like reptiles do today in temperate climate zones, or migrate to the tropics to the south. But a creature 50, 60 feet long, or even 20 or 30 feet long, could hardly burrow in the mud, and therefore those that did not rapidly migrate to the tropics soon became extinct, died out forever. Now, the fact that the climate of the world did suddenly change into a cold climate pattern and thus brought about the extinction of the great dinosaurs is being widely recognized today by scholars who certainly have no interest whatever in the Genesis account of creation and the flood. I would like to refer, for example, to the evolutionary-oriented volume by Adrian J. Desmond entitled The Hot-Blooded Dinosaurs, A Revolution in Paleontology, published by the Dial Press. In this volume, page 188, I quote this analysis of the situation that brought about the change of the world. I quote, "The sudden and obvious demise of the most gigantic and dramatic element of the fauna has resulted in a certain short-sightedness in looking for its cause. We tend to overlook the fact that in the depths of the ocean, less spectacular organisms were also being destroyed. If we are to see dinosaurian extinction in context as part of a worldwide cross-faunal trans-environmental catastrophe, it should be instructive to turn from the most conspicuous member of the Cretaceous landscape, namely the dinosaur, and focus instead on the less dramatic members of its seascape." Page 189. "At the same time, the ocean waters were cooled drastically. The great climatic changes which must have taken place probably were the cause of the extinction of the heat-loving biologic groups so characteristic of the late Mesozoic. The cold water Danian fauna represents the start of a new evolutionary sequence." Page 190. "The implications of these studies on plankton and fossil land plants are clear. The Earth was plunged into a cold period and the effect was felt both in sea and on land. The worldwide destruction of plankton, ammonites, and reptiles in the oceans, and dinosaurs, pterosaurs, and plants on land appears to take place in a catastrophically short time. In nearly all cases, their disappearance from the rocks is so abrupt that many authorities are talking in terms of a synchronous decimation of these ubiquitous groups in less than 1 million years. M. N. Bramlett of the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, in a study of the massive destruction of plankton, estimates that only thousands of years were required for its completion. Others consider that a few days would suffice. The simultaneous annihilation over the entire Earth's surface has led to some, at first sight, bizarre explanations. Cataclysmic theories, ruled out of geology since the age of Baron Cuvier, whose theory of mass extinctions involving inexplicable revolutions or catastrophes coincided rather appropriately with the most vigorous years of the French Revolution, have made a dramatic re-entry. An event that could bring an abrupt end to groups as diverse as dinosaurs and plankton simultaneously across the surface of the globe had to be of truly cosmic proportions." And I continue my quotation from this remarkable book by Adrian Desmond, turning now to page 194. "Speaking of these dinosaurs and why they vanished from the earth, unable to hibernate because of their unwieldy size, these leviathans would have frozen to death." And finally, page 195. "According to the latter-day catastrophists, the dinosaurs existed with the most spectacular bang since creation, and the geologists' lingering aversion to cataclysms notwithstanding, it is becoming difficult to disagree. Although the timing of the event is still hotly contested, there is little disagreement over its geological suddenness. The debate now focuses on just how sudden. A similar conclusion is reached in the remarkable article in the August 1978 National Geographic magazine by John H. Ostrom of Yale University, in his article entitled A New Look at Dinosaurs. I read on page 178. At the same time that the dinosaurs were dying out, a dramatic extermination of other life forms occurred. In the sea, the reptilian sea monsters disappeared, together with the coil-shelled ammonites, relatives of the modern squid and nautilus. Massive extinctions occurred on the sea's microscopic planktonic life. On land, certain plants vanished, and the flying reptiles disappeared. And then on page 184, no one knows what did the dinosaurs in, but I favor the cooling environment hypothesis. Whether the cold was caused by shifting continents, or by an exploding supernova, or a combination of both. End of quote. And I would suggest that we don't need to look for such mechanisms at all, because the Word of God, the book of Genesis, makes clear that these creatures were destroyed not by some accident of a supernova or by some accident on earth beneath, but by divine judgment and a transformation permanently of this planet through the catastrophism of the Genesis flood. Now, we do know that some of the greatest plant-eating dinosaurs succeeded in migrating at least as far south as the Jordan River, because there in the book of Job, God showed him one of the last survivors, Behemoth, perhaps Supersaurus, sitting in the river as if he had been preserved to demonstrate to the human race that God's great wisdom and power in creation was still available for man to observe and to marvel at. Of course, the Behemoth left no fossil remains in the Jordan River, because fossilization can only occur under the rare circumstances of enormous hydrodynamic catastrophism. But the record, the inspired record of Scripture, leaves us with no option. Genesis does teach, along with Job, that men and dinosaurs did live on the same earth together.